Welcome to this segment of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now we welcome back David Barton, who has written a book called The Jefferson Lies. It was out of print for a while, and now there's a refurbished version available at WorldNet Daily. And all of David's resources can be found at wallbuilders.com. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jerry. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
All right. Now, I like to say that you have forgotten more American history than 98% of us have ever learned. But there's obviously controversy surrounding the first version of this book, The Jefferson Lies. Do you care to comment on that?
Yeah, there was controversy. It was, in many ways, a tempest in a teapot, in that out of it was on the New York Times bestseller, and six academics decided to go after it, and only one of them had ever written in American history before, early American colonial period, and five of them, that was not their area, but they went after it, and actually several of them didn't go after the book, they just went after me. And so it got picked up by Christian things saying, oh, Barton gets all attacked all the time by secular folks, but never by Christian folks. There must be, where there's smoke, there's fire. And so the publisher at that time, Thomas Nelson, pulled it down, never even contacted me. And I told him who was going to be the attackers. And I also gave them all the documentation for the attack that would come, and they never did either. They just pulled it. So at that point, it allowed me to take all the claims that had been made by the attackers, go back and research them, see whether they were right or not, and what is the result is the new version that's come out. It's about 45% new content, and it is so cool because we get to touch so many more issues than we did in the first book and give so much more information about the Founding Fathers and Jefferson and the colonial culture than we were able to the first time, and it really, really does knock their feet out from under them. And this time we came back with just a ton of academic endorsements as well. We got several dozen professors and heads of universities and college presidents and others to read and critique the book and endorse it. So we were prepared for it this time, and the content, really, Jefferson, the same thematic message is there. We've changed some areas. Some areas needed polishing. One of the things that Nelson did was cut about 60,000 words out of it, and it was pretty choppy and pretty rough. They just didn't go back and re-edit as they should have. And so this allowed us to really make it smooth and add more content and really kind of put the hammer down on the critics as well.
All right. Why don't you give us an overview of the seven lies, and then I want to make my own little comment and ask you about something related to that whole controversy.
Yeah, and let me give a big overview by just going to the Founding Fathers in general.
Okay.
One of the tactics that we learn out of the Bible is that when you want to go after a message, you go after the messenger. And so when Jesus has a big following, what you do is you get the religious leaders to say, he's a wine bibber. He's a glutton. Well, I don't want to learn from him. If he's a drunkard and a party guy, that's not my guy. And so you do these character kind of attacks. And so for a number of generations, we venerated the Founding Fathers. We understood they had flaws. They had blemishes. They were human individuals. But we also understood that they were owned to some principles that were timeless. And those principles they used, God-given stuff that they were able to grasp and by the providence of God, put into documents that caused us to be unique from any other nation. And so we used to learn those principles and go through those principles despite any blemishes they might have. We've been, in the last 30 to 40 years, so viciously attacking those guys because, I mean, quite frankly, if you want to stop studying Washington's Farewell Address, which is a timeless piece, you've got to go after Washington. And you got to make him, he wasn't a religious guy, he's a deist. Oh, by the way, he had affairs with Sally Fairfax. And by the way, and so we've heard all this litany of stuff come out in the last 30 to 40 years.
And those things aren't true.
And they aren't true. None of them are true. And the same with wine bibber and a glutton. When they accuse Jesus of that, that wasn't true. But it's designed to take people away from their teachings. And so the same with Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson really is the only founding father consistently relied upon by the progressive left. And in the U.S. Supreme Court, in First Amendment cases, the U.S. Supreme Court and lower federal district courts quote Jefferson on the First Amendment more often than they quote the First Amendment itself. So Jefferson is their guy, and it's not that they quote Jefferson in its entirety. They just use eight words they like from one of his letters. And so Jefferson is seen to be the authority. So what happens is when you come back and say, you know, you guys have used Jefferson to secularize America, And Jefferson would be the first guy to pop up and say, this is nuts. This is wrong. We don't want a secular America. And so when you start doing that, then what you find is that kind of left-leaning academia, left-leaning scholarship, left-leaning journalism. Man, you've gone after their golden calf. You've gone after their idol. You can't do that. And so that really is what started so much of the furor, is that I insinuate, and I don't insinuate, I openly declare that Jefferson is not the secularist they have made him out to be. He's not the anti-religious guy, anti-cleric guy. He's not perfect in Christian theology by any means, but he is not the guy they've made him out to be. And so that's what we really try to do in the book, is recover much of the image of Jefferson that's historically accurate and show that he should not be the basis of so many public policies that he's used for right now.
Hmm. Well, I know, for example, I've worked on a book with Dr. Mark Belisle that came out after your book, and so I was very much aware of the controversy, the Doubting Thomas book about Thomas Jefferson. But we saw, you know, okay, there were rebuttals to your book, and I looked at your book, and then I read the rebuttals, and then I noticed, wait a minute, there's common ground here anyway. Everybody is saying, for example, that Thomas Jefferson on a regular basis went on Sunday mornings to the U.S. Capitol to worship. You know, there were regular Christian worship services, and Jefferson was a regular participant in those. Even your critics were saying that, and of course you were saying that, and boy, that violates everybody's understanding of the separation of church and state by today's standards. I mean, think about it. Here's the U.S. president and all these people within the government going to worship Jesus Christ in the Capitol. I mean, every Sunday? That's because the city was new and there weren't church buildings having been built. And these services, by the way, lasted until sometime in the 1880s. So this is an amazing kind of stuff, and you brought it to our light in this book, The Jefferson Lies. Why don't you review just a highlight of some of those lies? Just rattle them off, if you would.
It's even worse than what you say, Jerry, because Jefferson not only attended those services, he actually helped facilitate them. I mean, it's even worse than that. He recruited some of the preachers who preached on Sunday morning in those services. And even more than that, over in his executive department as president, they start Sunday services at the War Department, at the Treasury Department, and at the Navy Yard. So if you want to go to church on Sunday in Washington, D.C., choose a government building. And Jefferson is the one who helps facilitates all of that.
But what about the separation of church and state?
Exactly, exactly. And see,
well, what's your answer? What's your answer to that?
Well, excuse me.
Sure.
The answer to that is I am a huge supporter of separation of church and state, as Thomas Jefferson was, as was every Christian minister or most Christian ministers in America, not in Europe. But the separation of church and state as God established in the Bible is not what the court has given it to us right now. And separation of the Bible is God sets up a nation. He makes Israel. He said, here's how we're going to do it, guys. You're going to have Moses over the civil stuff. You're going to have Aaron over the spiritual stuff. I got two separate individuals over two separate institutions. One guy doesn't run both of them. And when King Uzziah came in 2 Chronicles 26,
yes,
and said, I'm going to be a priest and a king, God struck him down and said, no, you're not. Priests,
yes,
and kings are different.
Yeah.
And so we had institutional separation until 391 A.D. when Emperor Theodosius said, I'm emperor, and by the way, I rule the world, and you're all going to be Christians or I'm going to kill you. And at that point, you had, for the first time, government take over church doctrine. And for the next 1,200 years, the church and the state were the same thing. And what the king said, when Henry VIII wanted a divorce and the Catholic Church wouldn't give it to him, he said, no problem, I'll just start my own state church. We'll call it the Anglicans, and I'll give myself a divorce. I actually have documents out of the founding era from Great Britain back in that time where the Parliament is telling you who can and cannot preach the gospel. Parliament is telling you who can and cannot take communion. Mm-hmm. That's not the business of government. So in about 1580, you have the first guy in Great Britain to use the phrase separation church and state. He was actually the pastor. Well, he was Richard Hooker, and he said there's got to be a separation between church and commonwealth. The commonwealth is not supposed to be setting doctrine and punishing people for not following doctrine. Mm-hmm. Then the leader of the pilgrims, Reverend Greenwood, popped up and said, there's only one head of the church, and that head of the church is Jesus Christ. It's not Queen Elizabeth.
Amen.
For that, he got killed.
Ew.
And then they passed a law that says anyone who criticizes the ecclesiastical position of the queen will face prison without bail. So if you're going to say that Jesus is head of the church rather than Queen Elizabeth, you're going to jail and you'll never get out. That's when the pilgrims left and went to Holland, eventually from Holland to America. When they get to America, they do exactly what the Bible says. They separated church and state. They elected their own state leaders. They elected their own church leaders. They had annual elections, not biannual elections. They made sure that people had leaders in church and state separate. And that's the way we set it up. So when Jefferson writes his separation church and state letter, it's to the Danbury Baptists who are scared to death that in Connecticut the Congregationalists might try to make that the state denomination. And they actually object to the fact that the government documents guarantee the free exercise of religion. And you say, why would you object to that? And the answer was, they said, our free exercise of religion comes from God, not from government. We think that that clause even appearing in the documents might cause government to think it can regulate our religious rights.
Mm-hmm.
And Jefferson writes back and said, no, 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 there's a separation church and state. That's not going to happen. Separation church and state keeps government from regulating religious expressions. So that's his position. Separation church and state is what keeps the government from interfering with religious activities, like telling kids they can't say God at graduation, like telling kids at school what T-shirts they can and can't wear if it has Jesus Christ on it, like saying you can't have a nativity scene. But see, that's what separation was to do, was to make sure the government didn't stop those religious expressions. And that's why Jefferson did church at the Capitol. That's why Jefferson used federal funds to give to missionaries to the Indians. That's why, as you guys point out in your book, he had the War Department give federal funds for Christian schools for the Cherokees in Tennessee and just so many things, litany after litany that Jefferson does. It's just a long string of things that he does with public funds.
Yep.
And with government entities. And he understands separation church and state, but he understands that means that you don't secularize the public square, which is what it's become today.
You know, you're absolutely right. In fact, what they mean by separation of church and state is really, honestly, separation of God and state.
That's right.
And since Jefferson himself was the chief author of the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, the Declaration says that our rights come from God. Those God-given rights are non-negotiables. Okay, now, we are almost out of time, believe it or not.
Oh, man,
it's all right. I'm going to read your lies here. Thomas Jefferson fathered Sally Hemings' children. Thomas Jefferson founded a secular university. That's correct. It was non-sectarian. See, the secularists don't understand the difference between secular and non-sectarian.
That's
big
right.
difference.
That's right.
Thomas Jefferson wrote his own Bible and edited out the things he didn't agree with. Thomas Jefferson was a racist who opposed equality for black Americans. Thomas Jefferson advocated a secular public square through the separation of church and state. Thomas Jefferson detested the clergy. Thomas Jefferson was an atheist and anti-Christian. All of these are lies, and you show that to be the case. Your comments in the time that remains.
Yeah, and that's what we do in that book, is we have nearly 1,000 footnotes in that book, and we don't just quote professors saying this or that. We go back to the original documents. We let Jefferson speak for himself. And that's why the Jefferson Lies is so good, because it helps renew and refresh our mind. You get a different view of history. When you get a different view of history, you get a different view of the culture today and of the public policies that you want and of the leaders you want to represent you. That's why the Bible tells us so often, go back to the former days, recall the former times, the times of old. And that's what we try to do with the Jefferson Lies, is get people back to the actual documents, like Josiah when they discovered the scroll in the temple. And they said, you mean we used to be like this? And it completely changed the course of that nation when they went back to their history. And that's why we put this book out.
Hmm. Okay, well, we still have about a minute left. What else do you want to say? And by the way, I'm often asked when I'm on some of these radio shows, what's your comment about David Barton and the controversy surrounding his book? And a lot of times what I'll do, I'll play it very safely. I say, well, David dealt with some things that Mark and I chose not to deal with in light of what happened. You know, we didn't even deal with the issue of slavery. We just chose not to, and only focused on religion and so forth. But a lot of the things that you say and point out are absolutely true. I mean, for example, Jefferson didn't take the Bible and edit out all the miracles. Instead, what he does is he presents a lot of the teachings of Jesus. Some of those things include some miraculous elements. How about in the time that remains, talk about the Jefferson Bible, so-called.
Yeah, the Jefferson Bible, there's two of them, and they're exactly what he said. The first was the philosophy of Jesus of Nazareth being a bridge from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John for the use of the Indians, uncomplicated by matters that are beyond their comprehension. It's really a synoptic gospel. He took the teachings of Jesus, pasted them end to end, the same way we do with new Christians. We give them the Gospel of John. It's an abridgment of the Bible, and that's what he did. And it has plenty of supernatural stuff in it. The second is called The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, And after going through about three dozen known national leaders over 3,000 years, he read their writings on morality. He said the morals of Jesus beats all of these guys, and that's what he did, was collected 81 moral teachings of Jesus. Even that includes the supernatural. He was not going after doctrine. He was going after an abridgment of the Gospels for the use of Indians, brand new converts, and he's going after teaching the morals of Jesus to change people's behavior. Those two books are exactly what he said they were.
Your website for the book, or is it just wallbuilders.com?
It's, wallbuilders.com or WorldNet Daily, or Amazon's got it, and it's still doing super well on Amazon. So any of those sites will get you the book.
The Jefferson Lies by David Barton. David, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Jerry. Appreciate all you do, brother.
All right, you too. Bye-bye now.